Okay, let's get started. So last Thursday, instead of teaching you, I was stuck in a depressing place here. And as if that wasn't enough, on Friday, I was stuck here. Let me see if I can get this for you. And so you can imagine how happy I am to be back teaching you. So if I cannot contain my enthusiasm today, please forgive me. Question, are there any questions? That's Great Barrier Reef, by the way. It's the largest coral reef in the world. In fact, the only, I mean, their claim to fame is that's the only living thing that can actually be seen from the moon. It's the size of Great Britain. I just saw a little part of it. But I did go to the conference, so if any university people ask you, don't say that, you know, I showed you this video. Okay. So, what I am planning to do today is to transition from information retrieval, traditional information retrieval, to information retrieval for search engines. Okay, and we'll do that starting today. So before I do that, are there any questions about anything that we have done? I'm assuming that you all listened to the, I mean, those of you who did not make it to the makeup class already listened to the indexing lectures. Anyway, you would have to because the project is based on that. And then I assume that if you had any questions on the project, the TA's help was able to, it was enough to start you off. Okay, so, and then I think by the time I leave, you should give me your homeworks, right? Make sure that you put them here so that I'll take them with me. Okay, so what I am going to do is this idea of connecting it to the IR to search engines. We've been doing this in the back of our, as like a background discussion all the time anyway. It's not like we didn't know that we were ultimately going to do web search, okay? However, it's worth, you know, thinking of what are some of the characteristics of information retrieval on the web as against traditional information retrieval. Okay, so here are some ideas, and maybe you can tell me more, okay? So one here is web pages are very voluminous. So you can think of the pages as documents, okay? Web pages are very voluminous and diversified. There are large numbers of them. They're coming up all the time. They're widely distributed on many servers and extremely dynamic and volatile. That means, you know, people are putting pages, people are removing pages, people are changing the existing pages, right? And then, you know, all sorts of fun things like that. And so there is that problem. Now, why is this different from traditional IR? In traditional IR, you assume you know the catalog that you're going to index, okay? And people aren't exactly writing books, you know, one book a second, okay? So library guys don't have to worry about extremely volatile documents coming and going, okay? And also one of the interesting things is in the library there is this ISBN number, you know, which is not every Joe Schmo can get a book. I mean, even if you at least need to have money to pay for the Vanity Press so that you can get a book published, whereas anybody can put up a web page. So there's barely any quality control on what's on the web. Okay, and then you know, and the number of pages is obviously hugely bigger than the number of documents or papers that you might consider. Okay, so there is that issue. Okay, and obviously we need to do something to deal with that. What parts of the traditional IR do you think would change because of this? What parts of the traditional IR would change because of this? So yes, you have to re-index the pages. That's one interesting thing. So you have to maintain the index. Furthermore, actually, okay, anything else? In fact, there's a huge, big thing staring at you as to, you know, in the case of web pages. Yes, you have to re-index the pages, but you first need to index them. And where do you get the pages?
Crawl them.
Crawl them. That's a big deal, right? I mean, IR doesn't have to crawl for the documents. The assumption is that all the documents that you want to index are given to you. Okay, nobody is submitting their documents to, you know, the search engines. Although some, you know, crazy services say, give your, if you pay us $30, then we will submit your URL to Google, because we know Sergey and Larry quite well, and, you know, they'll quickly index your page. That's all nonsense. Really, most of what really happens is that crawlers go around crawling for the pages. And you need to write these crawlers such that pages lurking in every nook and cranny are brought out and put it in some place so that you can construct an index on them. So crawling is important. Reindexing is important. Furthermore, indexing itself is important, because the indexing techniques that we may have talked about for normal IR may not scale up to web scale, because a much larger number of documents that you have to index. Okay? So the thing that will change here is we'll learn about crawling, and we'll learn about how to scale up the indexing techniques. Okay? And we'll say a little about, you know, what can you do to dynamically reindex. Okay. The next thing, of course, is that the other point is that web pages have more structure than normal pages, normal documents, normal, you know, pay, you know, books and so on. In the sense that they are tagged, they have these HTML tags. You can say blink begin and then something and blink end, and then that thing will keep blinking at you, right? And then you can say H1 and then some text and, you know, slash H1, which will be bigger font. Okay, there is structure in these pages. So, so if this is sort of a headache, but this is an opportunity. Okay, and furthermore, in fact, the other structure in the web pages is the connections between the pages is easily navigable. Okay, books do talk about other books, but it's very hard to see, you know, what book they are pointing to, because it's written in English or some natural language, and you cannot quite dereference that English text and say, oh, that's what you're pointing to. Whereas web pages have href links. Okay, not only that, when they have an href link, they will say, for really good time, go to, and some page name. Okay, if you want to know how a real dweeb looks like, go to, and some page name. Okay, all of this is giving you, in essence, more information about the page that's being pointed to than the page itself does. Okay, so in fact, one of the interesting things here is this business of, this is part of, this anchor text is part of extra structure you have. By the way, the anchor text, by, you know, I assume you know this, but when you start an href and say you write a bunch of text and then you put a link, that's called the anchor text. Okay, that text normally shows up in blue or something, when you render it. But, you know, in general, by anchor text, I mean anything, you know, some block of text that surrounds the link. Okay, a few words before, a few words after, that surround the link. Okay, that must be saying something about the link. It's a reasonable heuristic. Now, what's interesting is that this page P has its own text. But this link, whatever is the text surrounding the link to this page, belongs to some extra annotation on this page. This is what other people think about this page. And this basically now becomes an index, an index term for that page. So now one of the neat things in the web, when the structure is easily available, is that I can tar you. And if I don't like your page, I'll get a whole bunch of people to point to your page and calling you bad names, right? And if all of us call you bad names, the same bad name in particular, then that particular bad name becomes part of your index term. So whenever I'm looking for that bad name, your page will come up. Okay? This is basically Google bombs. This is how you say unelectable George Bush would come up. I guess God knows who's coming up right now. But you know, all these things, essentially, you can change. So when you can annotate other pages, then in essence, you are effectively changing the content of the other pages as far as the search engine is concerned. You can see this as a great thing, or you can see this as a big noise, big, you know, headache. But ultimately, you can, in fact, exploit this structure. Okay? In fact, one can say that what others think of a page is more important than what the page says about itself. Right? Because have you ever seen a travel page which says it's not the best travel page in the world? Have you ever seen any commercial page which says we are number fifth, or like, you know, fourth from the bottom of the pages that sell transistor radios? You know, it's just, there's no market for it. So everybody says we're the top of the thing. So what you really want is what others think about that page. Perception is reality. If all of us think George Bush is unelectable, then he's unelectable. Okay. Unfortunately, what happened in those kinds of Google bombs is Democrats were sitting and making Google bombs on George Bush in 2004 instead of actually going and voting. So on the web, he was unelectable, but in reality, surprisingly, to all these people's surprise, I guess, you know, he got elected. Okay. So, but the point, of course, is that the perception can be, you know, the anchor text is defining the perceptions of a page, and it's a very useful information. One of the classic stories that people tell is that in the beginning, Netscape used to be, how many of you even know Netscape? Okay, good. Netscape was the original browser, right? Original big browser that everybody knew. And in the home page of Netscape, there was no word browser in it. Because they knew they were browser. Don't have to say we are browser. But on the other hand, if you're searching for browser, how do you get Netscape's page? It's because everybody else was pointing to Netscape and saying, browser, browser, browser. You know, it's like, you know, on the playground, you're showing people and saying, you know, browser, 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 kind of thing. So that was the way you get to that page. Okay, so it was an advantage. So the fact that web pages have extra structure can be exploited to improve retrieval in some sense. You know, anchor text is one case. And also, for example, if the page has a huge amount of text, and some of it is in blinking text, and some of it is in like this big a font, presumably whoever wrote that page thought that this stuff in big font is the most important description of this page. Right? So you should give those words a little more credit. So in fact, the same word appearing in the header should get little more weight than appearing in small print. Okay, so all this stuff is actually, you know, you can use this, and in fact search engines use it. We'll talk a little about that. And so that, but this is actually an opportunity. The other thing is web search is noisy. Okay, pages with very high similarity to query may still differ in relevance because there is no central authority which decides which pages get onto the web. Anybody can make web pages. It's very adversarial because in fact people would make pages which will have certain keywords because they know people are searching for those keywords. And you would go to the page and you won't even find those keywords. In fact, a classic thing that, you know, used to be a big deal in the old days is to put some words white on white so that you can't see them. When you get to the page, you don't see them. But these are all huge number of keywords that appear on the page. You know, obviously, anything related to pornography is a great sell. Okay, so you would add lots and lots of these kinds of words onto your page. Okay, just so that any random search is likely to bring your page up. Because unlike books in the library, which don't have motivations and which don't want to necessarily become the answer to a query, pages on the web have people behind them, and they want those pages to be brought up in the results as much as possible. So it's quite adversarial. They're actually out there to bring up their page, whether or not it's relevant sometimes. Do you understand what I'm saying? So it's the good old days of traditional IR where only the books which have been given ISBN number by Library of Congress would actually make it to the library, and so you just then have to consider among those books which is the best book, is now replaced by among the volume of pages which are reasonable pages. Just because they have the words, they seem to have the words you're looking for, doesn't necessarily mean that they're actually relevant at all. Maybe those words are in white on white. And in fact, this stuff wants to sell you something completely different. Okay? So this is again, so the top one is a problem, we'll talk about solutions. The bottom one is an opportunity, we'll talk about ways of exploiting it. The second one is an opportunity, we'll talk about ways of exploiting it. The third one is again a problem. because you know you don't quite know how to deal with the noise. And one thing, there are multiple ways you try, and one of the ideas is essentially to take the link structure between the pages into account and talk about what are trustworthy pages, what are not trustworthy pages, what are important pages, what are not important pages. And so you kind of tend to develop an orthogonal metric over and above the similarity as defined by vector similarity. And say that gives you additional information as to how this page is relevant. You know, of the many pages which have the query words, which should I show first? You know, the top 10 is the most important real estate. In fact, top 3 is the most important real estate. Which of them will get into the top 3? Okay? And again, this becomes a bigger issue because we are actually talking about pages that have more or less all the words. And still you want to differentiate them because it could be that some of them are totally fake pages which put those words with adversarial intent. You know, they just wanted to be brought up. They had really nothing to say for that query. Okay? You are used to this. I mean, you live in this world, right? I mean, the web world. But I mean, but from a traditional IR point of view, this is a big change. So we have to talk about how to deal with this, and that's where basically the link analysis stuff comes. And then the last one is web users are ordinary folks, okay, without any special training. And they tend to submit very short queries. And they're also, there's a large user community and they're somewhat easy to please. They know that, you know, basically they get what they pay for. Basically they're paying nothing for this service. Okay? And they're generally happy to get anything. Which is actually an opportunity. This basically means that you don't have to kill yourself, you know, finding the right similarity metric, et cetera, because the queries are really small. Okay, and they're not really documents. And it's not exactly the case that people are trying to differentiate between the slight shades of meaning between technical papers. Okay, and the large number of users means that even if in fact I can construct pathological examples for any particular technique, right, that I can show that, oh, you should not have brought up this page. You should have brought up this particular, you know, biology paper, not this biology paper. But among the web users, the number of biology people is minuscule. So even if you lost all of them, you still have a huge number of web users who are generally happy. Okay, so your customer base is actually easier to please to some extent compared to, let's say, an IR system that's meant for professional biologists or professional computer scientists or something else. So that's actually an opportunity. So as I said, these are all the problems, and the first one, you need to crawl and maintain the index. We'll talk about that. The second one, we need to use the links and tags and the metadata to take that into account in indexing the pages. Okay. The third one, there are many other ideas. You have to somehow have a notion of importance and trustworthiness of a page. That is not easy to fool. That at least requires a large scale collusion. Okay? And we have worried about this because every lawyer says they are the best lawyer in the world. Every doctor says they are the best doctor in the world. Every carpet cleaning company says they are the best carpet cleaning company in the world. How do you decide when you try to call a carpet cleaning company? I mean, very few people just randomly open the Yellow Pages, which no longer exist, by the way, and see, you know, a carpet cleaning company. More likely than not, you're likely to ask your friend, you know, what's the one that you've been using and are you happy with them? So we deal with this, you know, in a situation where people can sell services without any obvious guarantees about the trust involved. We compute the trust by talking to our friend. Okay? This is basically, we use social network analysis to figure out, you know, which are the right people to deal with, which are the wrong people to deal with. And we will do the same thing for web pages. Okay? And again, the last one, of course, this is easily impressed. So in some sense, I won't have much to say about this other than ask you to keep in mind that, in fact, you know, web queries are mostly 2.3 words large. Okay? So it's like a very different kind of easier to please people. And in fact, if you remember, in one of the classes I pointed out that the queries can be split into navigational, informational, and transactional. Navigational means I want the URL of United. Okay? And informational means I want to learn about some particular topic. And transactional is sort of, you get to navigate to a place and do the transaction. And the large number of queries on the web tend to be, for the ones for which people are extremely happy with the results, tend to be navigational queries. For informational queries, as I pointed out last time, there is no such thing as I'm feeling lucky. You can't feel lucky for information queries because you don't know what's the right information that you need, actually. But for navigational queries, there is a unique answer, and you know, most of the time, and all that needed to be found is that query. So that's part of the reason, you know, that is, and the navigational queries are quite different from the kind of queries for which IR technology has been developed. Right? In fact, in IR, if you want a very specific book, the way to search for it is by call number. Right, because that's a key for the key that the book. In the library, if you want a very specific book, you use a, you know, the call number. Okay, so this is what we're going to do. Of these, today we will do this and this. And then towards the end of today, I'll start talking about how to use social structure. But rather than directly go into how to do link analysis and social structure analysis in the context of web pages, I want to actually use that as a digression for social networks. Okay, just as we did traditional IR and then got into web IR, when we get to the point of trust propagation and, you know, trust evaluation of the pages, I first will spend, I think, 1.5 to 2 classes talking about traditional social network analysis, because we had dealt with this in the past. You know, people always talked about who is the most important actor in movies, or who is the most important computer scientist in computer science. Okay, who is the most widely read computer scientist in computer science? You know, all these questions, we have thought about it and we have developed techniques for that. Okay, so we will first look at what are the traditional social network analysis techniques, and then go from there to the thing that you're probably waiting for, which is PageRank, authority subs, etc., which is really a generalization of some of those techniques for the case of web, a specialization of some of those techniques for the case of web. Okay, so that's the way we're going to deal with this. Questions? Okay, so first thing we were talking about, you know, the fact that we need to crawl and maintain index, and so the next several minutes we'll talk about some of those issues. There is not too much analytical to talk about here, but it's sort of engineering issues. It turns out, for example, that writing a crawler, anybody can do. Writing a crawler that is very high throughput and doesn't, you know, annoy people, you know, by, you know, hitting the same page, the same server too fast, okay, and deals with faults gracefully is harder. Okay, so the engineering issues are harder. There is actually one paper that I mentioned in the readings list for crawler, which is the original Mercator paper from which these slides are coming from. But to give you a feel as to how topical development of robust crawlers remains, last WWW, World Wide Web Conference, is the most important conference for this general area. There are special conferences, SIGIR, PHIR, machine learning conferences are there, web services conferences are there, but WWW basically brings all these people together. And the last year, WWW, the best paper, or at least one of the best papers, went to a public domain crawler that some folks from UT Arlington, I believe, designed and made it available. Okay, and it's worth reading that paper too. I'll make a link for that too. I won't discuss too much of the engineering details, but those of you who are interested in getting more into crawling, you should look at those papers. Okay, so you want to retrieve pages for indexing by web search engines. You have to basically start from, you know, nothing, and then, you know, go to various pages. You need to make up URL names and go to those pages and then bring them down. Okay? So the normal, there are two types of crawlers. One is crawling for general search engines, which is the one that we'll mostly talk about. That basically means bring every possible URL, I mean, from the web, okay, so that we can index it. What's more interesting is, I mean, a different issue is topic-specific crawlers. Suppose you're developing a search engine for computer science papers, okay? Then you don't want to necessarily bring in the entire set of pages of the world and then filter out the non-computer science pages, but rather actually crawl such that you're more likely to bring in computer science pages than the non-computer science pages. So topic-specific crawling is actually a much more interesting and more researchy topic even now. Okay, but we will talk mostly about general crawling, where it's just get all the topic, all the URLs that you can reach. Okay, so the usual questions are what page to look at next, and avoid overloading a site, because these crawlers nowadays are huge distributed behemoths, and if they start hitting a server saying, give me a page, one per every microsecond or something, the server will be brought to the knees. Okay, then what will they do? They will try to stop the crawler from accessing their site completely, which is not good. Okay, so there is some sort of a politeness constraint that you have to take into account. Let's not ask any site, queries, basically URL queries, in rapid succession. Give epsilon time between two successive requests. Okay, that's an important thing. And then also the other issue is once you reach a site, once you reach a page, if you start with, how do you even start? You start with some bunch of URLs, but then you start growing them, because when you get the pages from those URLs, they will have embedded URLs, and then they will be added to the queue, and then they would be crawled. Okay, so in essence, you are hoping that the web is connected in a reasonable way, and that you have a reasonable number of seed URLs that you start from, and then so you can start going deeper and deeper from them. Okay, deeper in the sense you're going from page to page to page, and then at each page you get extra URLs that you need to focus on. Okay, and then the other issue, which is a big deal, is how frequently to recrawl a page. Because the fact that world is dynamic and the pages are changing means that what you index this page today may be different, because tomorrow I would have changed the content of the page and I have put more stuff, I removed old stuff, so I need to reconstruct the index. Okay, in fact, one level of importance of your page is how often Google hits your page, right? Because if it's an important page, Google or any of your search engines, because if you're an important page, they're more likely to keep track of the changes in the page. Okay, if you are an important but unchanging page, you are not likely to have to be. So there are like two aspects. One is how fast is the page changing, and second is how important is this page to begin with. Okay, and you definitely want to get to the important fast changing pages first, and the other ones slower and slower. Okay, so which actually means some notion of page importance has to be computed beforehand, and you can assume right now that one idea would be something like a page rank. For example, keep track of pages with higher page rank, because that's one way of defining importance, more often than the ones with lower page rank. Okay? Okay, now there are worth talking about a little, but for those of you who may never have heard about this, there is a sort of a protocol for crawling pages. If you put stuff in your website that you don't want search engines to index, right, there is a gentlewomanly protocol which says, search engine, please don't index this directory or the subdirectories below it. And there is a way of saying that by putting a file called robot.txt in your top web directory. Okay, and then that lists all the subdirectories that you don't want search engines to crawl. Okay, and it would look like this essentially. So it can actually tell you that Google, please crawl this. Yahoo, don't crawl this. You can say that too. So you can tell, basically when a server hits you, you know the URL from which the server is hitting you. Okay, and then these basically can say, if your name is web crawler, then do not index stuff in news, do not index stuff in temp. Okay, now of course, web is adversarial in more than one way. It's adversarial in the sense we can make up stuff. It's also adversarial in the sense search engines can ignore whatever we ask them to do. Okay, in fact, if I were a search engine, I would say, well, this guy is trying to hide something. Maybe that's the important stuff. So let's go ahead and, you know, index them anyway. And when was the last time anybody was able to actually successfully sue one of these search companies? Right? What's more interesting, actually, is connected to the issue of dynamically fast-changing web pages is that if you find that the web page got indexed and you don't want the world to know that you have this secret fetish of some sort, and you want to remove this page, so that at least when they come back to the URL, that page doesn't exist anymore. Well, tough luck, because search engines such as Google also maintain a cache, right? They maintain a cache of all the pages that they have crawled. So for at least 6 months or so, the world will know that you had this problem. And then, in fact, one of the funniest thing was that sometime back, my former advisor was going to shift from one university to another university. And he was still keeping it under wraps. One of his lab guys essentially had a blog, which was a reasonably influential blog, on which he said, you know, let it out that, you know, this guy is about to move on from here to there. And as soon as my advisor found out, apparently he went and told this guy, please take it out. He took it out. So, however, then when I wanted to check, I knew it was going to happen, and I wasn't sure when it was going to be official, and I asked Google, and it gave me a URL. I went to the URL. There was no URL there, but then I clicked on the cache, and it showed me exactly what this guy has written that has been removed. Okay, there is all these interesting ethical considerations that are brought up by what does it mean for, you know, what does it mean to cache somebody else's page without their permission? Okay, but we'll talk about that one day during this course. We'll talk about ethics on the web in terms of all sorts of interesting ethical considerations on the web, including not just search engines being bad to you, but also the culpability of the search engines, for example, when they can extract patterns from your emails, so much so that if my parents ever send me an email, they realize that this is written in Telugu, and I, you know, even though it's transliterated Telugu, they're able to figure this out, right? And they're showing me a whole bunch of Telugu advertisements written in Telugu, right? So the extraction technology has progressed to that point. So an interesting question is, if a bunch of terrorists are plotting, and they're sending Gmail to each other, let's say, you know, this is really, by the way, the hope of the Department of Defense, that all the bad guys would be using Gmail, and then you can just find them. They have never heard of PGP. So they're sending mails to each other, right? And then Google obviously can figure out what is in this to some extent. And if Google did not report this to the government, could you hold Google responsible? This is turning the tables, right? Instead of invading my privacy, so you should be held liable, you are holding the search engine liable for not being good Samaritan enough. You know, those of you who saw the last Seinfeld episode, you know, they were not being good Samaritans. They were supposed to, you know, squeal on these terrorists, and they didn't. So can you put them in jail? That's an interesting question. In fact, there are technical papers written on this topic, and we'll talk about it later. Okay, but for now, let's point out that robots.txt is the way gentlemanly agreement for between search engines and web servers. That, you know, I tell you not to look at these, and you should follow that. But nobody really enforces it. Yes, sir.
I didn't mention add a couple of
Mm-hmm.
So if you have pages that you will typically only want people internally to be able to link, you tell the robots not to spider those, so that way more of the page rank, more of the link juice, as he called it, is concentrated on pages that are
visible outside.
It's
a good point. Actually, we will talk about some of this stuff when we get to page rank and how to optimize with respect to that, which is just a very small point. You know, it's a big point in our world because one search engine seems to corner most of the market, and it seems to quote unquote use search page rank. But it's a small point in, you know, once you know how the world decides who is important, who is not important, you know, you want to work the system. It's only reasonable. I mean, everything important in life has an arms race. Okay? If it's important, then somebody is going to find a loophole in it. Saying, let there not be anybody who finds loopholes is kind of silly. You know, that basically means you are nothing important that you're talking about. Okay? So we will talk about how, for example, things like social network analysis and page rank, etc., can be circumvented, can be, you know, sabotaged by various things. The only thing you can hope for, essentially, is they are hard to sabotage. If they're extremely easy to sabotage, then you're in big trouble. Okay. So, you know, there is, you know, here is an architecture of the Mercator, and the more interesting thing is, as I said, you should read the paper. It's a nice text paper. It's an engineering paper, so it explains what they did, and some of the things that you would never have thought about, such as if you are writing a program, and if a page points to itself, and then you're doing depth first search, then you get into a cycle. Obviously, it's a no-brainer, okay, but you don't want to find it the hard way. After deploying a huge, you know, crawler onto the world, then after 2 days, you come and find that there is one page in the crawled index. That's a bad way to find out, right? You have to think about all these things. Okay, in fact, another interesting connection is that many times the same exact page is reached in multiple different ways. How many times are you going to index it? Okay, and I mean, that basically could be because I have like two different names to the page, and so I have essentially, you know, I have in the, you know, in the Unix system, I have a link to the same page under a different name. In fact, I have class pages which are available under different names. Okay, what's called notes.html is also intro.html. Okay, now the question is, you should realize that and you should keep only one copy of it. What's more interesting is sometimes the web page URLs come embedded with the session IDs, right? Do you people understand what session IDs are? Okay, now the same URL name with a unique session ID now trivially becomes a new URL. You should be able to at least realize that that part is session ID and remove it. Otherwise, you'll have 20,000 copies of the same page under different session ID names. None of these are really PhD level topics, right? I mean, if you realize it, you know how to change it. But if you don't take care of a huge number of these, then your crawler isn't going to be robust. That's the issue about engineering. You know, in a science, you can always tell, oh, you know, what exactly is the core interesting idea? But there is no core interesting idea about Brooklyn Bridge. There are 10,000 things that can go wrong, and the Brooklyn Bridge will fall down. Okay, everything has to work just right for the Brooklyn Bridge to not only survive, but survive for so long that we can talk about it. And so engineering is important. I bring this up because I'm not so much into engineering myself. And so I might be biased and shortchanging the importance of engineering crawlers and search engines. Okay, just because, you know, any reasonable teacher would unknowingly pass on their biases to you. Okay, so I'm telling you beforehand, and so sort of overcompensating for that, you know, you should take engineering seriously, and you should probably read more than what I tell you about crawlers. So anyway, here are the steps. This is not too hard to understand. You remove the URL from some queue. You simulate the network protocols, you know, HTTP, FTP. When this paper was written, there were really a large number of network protocols. None of them really won over yet. There was Gopher, there was FTP, there was HTTP. But now it's mostly HTTP. Okay? Then you read, and then you see the document and check whether the document has already been seen before. And how do you do that? You have to keep track of the fingerprints of the documents that have been seen. You don't really want to do a hard duplicate detection. Do you understand what I'm saying? So what you really want to do is compute something like a checksum, 64-bit checksum. And that basically ensures that if the checksum is the same, then they're very likely to be the same document. But they're different, they may still be the same document. Maybe they put an extra space, you know, in some innocuous place. Okay, so that's the kind of idea that you want to do, rather than that's not the kind of thing that I would use if I wanted, for example, to figure out whether or not you copied somebody else's term paper and submitted it to me. There are techniques now which basically take high school students and college students' term papers and you know, basically compare them to gazillion term papers that are freely available on the web to see whether or not they have copied. And when they do that, they can't do checksum, because even people who have been dropped on their heads know that you put an extra space, checksum will change. If you put an extra character, checksum will change. If you change the order of paragraphs, you know, you can take a paragraph from here, paragraph from there, paragraph from there, you can add a new term paper. Okay? So if I'm into that, I would do this the more time consuming way. But in the case of crawling, I want to get done very fast, and so I just use checksum. Okay? And then once I get the page, I have to extract links. Extraction of links is slightly involved because some of the links are direct, some are with respect to a base URL. Because in the top, you'll tell the base URL, and then you only give offsets from that URL. Again, nothing particularly hard, but you know, you have to write the program, which takes the base URL, connects it to this, and keeps track of, you know, dereferenced, completely dereferenced URLs. Okay, and then decide whether or not this URL should be downloaded, and if it should be, then throw it into the queue, and then continue. That's basically what crawler does. Okay, so the question, of course, is how do you actually maintain the queue of pending URLs? You start them probably with some set of seed URLs, and then the question is how do you pick the queue, pick a URL from it and expand. Now, those of you who have done any sort of search, especially 471 or even 310, know that search strategies differ from each other based on the way you manage the search queue. You can do last in, first out, which would be really bad because that would get you depth first, and so you'll go into loops because the page is pointing to itself. Okay? You can do breadth first, which is first in, first out. You can do priority queue, which is pages with higher importance are brought up to the front of the queue. Okay, the difference, the connection to search is a loose one because in the case of search, there is a goal that you're trying to reach. In the case of crawling, the goal is harder to define. What is the goal of a crawler? It really is to maximally get the most important, highly changing pages as fast as possible. That's the goal. It's not to get a single page. Okay. So really, the analogy to search is useful, but it's not very illuminating because you still have to essentially get to all of them anyway. And some of them you'll get to them more often than others. Okay. And for example, if you have already seen it before, that doesn't necessarily mean that you won't see it again. If it's an important page that changes often, then you still put it back in the URL. In fact, in general, when you remove it from the queue, you can put it back into the queue if it's an important one. Just put it in the back, right? And anyway, this stuff I already mentioned, you need to consider multiple, you have to simulate multiple connections, FTP connections, Gopher connections, and so on. And you need to know at least things like you should not give an HTTP connection and the server hangs and you stop doing everything else. Because you're a crawler, you want to continue. So you should know how to deal with timeouts. Again, nothing very big by itself. There's no huge research topic there. But if you don't deal with it, your crawler won't work. Okay? You need to look for crawler types that has infinite URL names, URLs talking to, connecting to themselves, and also URLs with session IDs embedded in them, all that stuff. Okay, and look at the section 5 of Mercator paper, which is available, which will give you a whole bunch of these kinds of special cases and how they deal with it. Okay. Okay, this is extracting web page, URLs from the web page. As already pointed out, there may be not all URLs on the web page may be absolute, so you at least should know things like here is the base one, and this seems to be a relative URL, so I add it to the base one to get the absolute one. Okay. And duplicate detection, as I pointed out, you use something like the checksum. You don't really use the full-scale duplicate detection because that's too costly. Okay. And then the other thing is, in terms of performance, it turns out that the maximum importance, maximally important thing for the performance of crawlers is caching. Okay. You cache the URLs in the frontier disk. You cache the robot exclusion rule so that when I get back to this page, again, I don't have to reread the robot exclusions page again. Well, I'm taking a chance. What if between my 1 microsecond back hit and the next hit, the user basically changed the robot.txt? well, heck with that. You know, I will cache it anyway. And for this whole session, I'll assume that it hasn't changed. Okay, again, these are things that are cache the DNS results, because when you get a URL name, that gets converted into ultimately a DNS, you know, by basically an actual IP number by calling the DNS, domain name server. And each of the domain name servers are costly. Domain name server calls are costly. So if you converted it once, don't reconvert it. It may be a couple of milliseconds, but that can make a huge difference. Okay, and then checkpointing yourself, because crawlers, parts of the crawlers can fail, you want to keep track of your state so that you know how to restart search from there rather than start from scratch. Again, you notice that all of these mean the crawler code, as I'm adding these special cases, the crawler code is increasing. There's nothing particularly hard about the code in the sense of the theory behind it, but there's a huge number of these special cases that you have to deal with. Okay. So in terms of the crawling strategies, as I said, there are, for the general search engines, you basically use some sort of a prioritized queuing, which takes into account the importance of the page, the rate at which it changes. For focused crawlers, it's a whole different ballgame. We'll talk a little bit about it, but somehow the whole point of focused crawlers is before you get to the page, you need to predict, is that page going to be relevant to the topic I'm crawling about? So if I'm a bicycle search engine, before I even get to a URL, I need to predict. Because going to the URL, reading the whole thing, and then saying, oh, it's not about bicycles, is pretty dumb, because that's as good as bringing everything and filtering bad ones out. So it turns out it's a learning issue. It's basically being able to predict. It's a classification learning. Being able to predict for any URL, is it on topic or off topic? And you need to learn it quickly and use that in predicting. We'll talk about it in a minute. Okay. This is, it's actually the way Mercator actually captures, maintains its queue. It's one specific implementation. And I would, if you're into crawling, as I said, please do read last year's the best paper award, crawling paper, that I'll make a, you know, link available, okay? Because that's the latest in terms of, you know, at least, again, most of the crawling technology, most of these, from here on, most of the important things that we talk about, there are no papers that describe the currently working system, because nobody wants to write papers about them, right? So normally what happens is that, you know, the crawler, the best crawler paper right now that I'm talking about, it's essentially something that is developed in this university, so they didn't mind giving it away. But on the program committee would be people from companies who would vet it and say, yeah, this is more or less like close to state of the art, and then so you have some reason to believe. But of course, the search engine guys on the program committee of the conference might basically let this paper in and give it a best paper award just because they want to send you all in the wrong direction. That's not the way Google works. Adversarialness is across the board. Do you understand what I'm saying? So I'm not, you know, just because you are not paranoid doesn't mean that Google isn't out to get you, right? So, you know, you have to take all of these with a pinch of salt, but this is the best we have about the latest crawling technology. Okay, Mercator actually was a crawler that was used by Alta Vista, which was one of the original search engines. And those days, people still used to write papers about what's working. Okay, so here is the way they were doing it, for example. So essentially, they have front queues and they have back queues. In the front queues, you put in all the extracted URLs into k different queues, okay, based on the importance. You know, larger number might be more important, smaller number may be more important, whichever you decide. And then one is, this, let's say this is important, this is less important. And you throw in the more important ones into the more important queue, less important ones into the less important queue. Now, how did you decide importance? Something like page rank, for example, but I would not necessarily worry about it right now. Okay, and so each URL goes into the front queue based on its priority. And in fact, priority is assigned based on the page importance and the change rate. As I said, both are important. If it's a very important page, but it's a page about the states in the US, it's not going to change too fast, unless some of us want to secede, or unless we take over extra countries. It's not going to change too fast, okay? So although it's an important page, it's not worth crawling so many times, okay? But somewhat lower important page, which changes fast, still has to go into a higher important thing. So that's why it's some sort of a weighted combination of, you know, page importance and the rate at which it changes. Okay, and now these URLs essentially are waiting in the back queues, and what Mercator would do is they have a selector which takes URLs from these back queues and puts into the front queues. the front there are, let's say, B queues, 1, 2, 3 up to B. Each of these queues work on a very specific server. So this one is for .asu.edu. This is for .arizona.edu. Okay, this is for some other server. The point is that everything in that server, then once you pick it, once you pick an item from that server, round robin, you go to somebody else before coming back to it. That's the way you can ensure that you don't hit the same server too many times. Just I'm giving you one realization of all the ideas that we talked about. Okay, so and then this all we know is that these are all for separate servers, but at different times they might refer to different servers based on what got shifted. Okay, and then from the back queue you then select in some round robin fashion, and then you actually send the URL out, and then you bring it in, and then you do everything else that I told you. That's one way. Okay. Now, as far as the focused crawling, that which is, remember I talked about general crawling and the focused crawling. In terms of focused crawling, it's actually a more advanced topic. We might come back to it later, but you know, the main point essentially is that you need a way of predicting when you pick a URL whether or not it's going to lead to a page of interest, a page that's relevant to the topic. So what you need to do is convert the URL name. Basically you have to write a classification algorithm. In particular, the obvious classification algorithm basically says, give me a URL name, I'll tell you yes or no. Okay, yes, it's relevant to bicycles. No, it's not relevant to bicycles. Why bicycles? Because in this slide I'm talking about a focused crawler for bicycle pages. Okay, now the point, of course, ultimately what I really want to do is take a URL and say it's about bicycles. No, it's not about bicycles. But that's a hard learning problem because there's not enough data in the URL name that tells you whether it's about bicycles or not. What you do instead is, given the place where the link to this URL is appearing, you look at the text around that URL name and use that text to classify whether or not it's relevant to bicycles. So a page which is about bicycles is likely to have links to bicycle pages. Also, a page where at some point of time it has a bunch of text about bicycles will now be, and has a URL embedded there, is probably pointing to a URL that's about bicycles. These are the kinds of heuristics that you use to actually set up the learning problem. Okay? And then you use some sort of a classifier and then pick, basically learn to predict, when URLs appearing on a page should be put in the queue and when they should be ignored. Okay, it's an interesting and more, somewhat deeper topic. We'll come back to it probably later when we talk about text classification, which is basically learning in the context of text. Okay, one thing I should mention to you is that for somebody who is a general search engine that has complete coverage, you don't need a separate focused crawler. You don't need a separate focused crawler, right? Because you can always just, you already got everything in the world anyway. All you need to do is just filter out the bad ones. Okay? This is more important if you are trying to write a bicycle search engine and Google isn't willing to give you access to their entire index. If Google wants to write a bicycle search engine, they don't do this because they already have a big crawl, and so they just have to filter out. They just take the subset that is relevant to bicycle. It's a different issue. Okay. Questions? Yes.
Sometimes we see that Google provides search for different sites, as in some search on that site is powered by Google.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. Actually, it's not very obvious. So for example, Google allows, there are two ways it can happen. One is Google allows site ASU and the search. There, all they're doing is they're taking their entire crawl and restricting the results only to the ASU one. That's it. But there is another way where, for example, a corporation might buy Google search appliance or some search engine search appliance, all that does is it's basically they're not going to expose those pages ever into the real world. They have a firewall and crawlers will never be able to get across that. In that case, essentially inside the corporation, you have an entire crawler which is crawling the pages in the corporation, indexing them, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? That's a different issue. Whether, so in fact, there is something that we might talk about later on as to whether or not the specific way Google ranks pages in general web search is going to be relevant for intra-corporate search. Okay, and for that, to keep that in, to understand that, you have to remember one of the points I made earlier, which is web search is for general user base. So if a subset are extremely unhappy, a 2% subset are extremely unhappy with Google, that doesn't matter. Because there's still 98% of them that are, seem to be reasonably happy. But if on the other hand, these are the 2% that you are selling the search engine to, and you're just helping their search, you know, that becomes 100% of your users being unhappy, and you need to actually change the ranking. So intra-corporate ranking is a slightly different issue. As I said, general search is actually easier because you have a variety of users, so any random thing you do, somebody would be happy. Right? So it's easier to please your user population because even if I get really mad because they didn't show my page when I said Subha Rao, you know, the other Subha Rao would be happy because his page came up. So, you know, it all evens out. So, as far as the crawling is concerned, the conclusion is that trivial spider, writing a trivial spider is trivial. It's not, there's no huge theory to talk about here, okay? But the challenge is writing one that's efficient and stable and doesn't get into traps and remains stable and it's distributed. That's another thing that we didn't talk about. In fact, one big issue is crawlers are distributed. They're different, you know, from the selector, basically, you get a URL, and then different, you know, machines will then be given these pieces of the URL. And this entire queue itself can be distributed. You know, writing a very good distributed crawler is trickier, obviously. I didn't even talk about those issues. Okay. And then, you know, at least at the time, I guess 5 or 6 years back, focus crawling is a hot direction. But now it's not so much because essentially, search engines are already making specialized search portals. And for them, they don't need to do focused crawling. They have the entire crawl, they just have to remove the bad guys. Okay? But still, it's an interesting topic if you want to do something, you know, on a vertical. So in fact, there is a name for this. It's called vertical search, which is essentially search for a particular domain. And there you have to get the topics, the documents related to that, just that topic, and support search on that. Okay? Okay, so the next thing I want to talk about, since we are into hardware, is basically the indexing part, which in some sense, this part of the class is just a continuation of the indexing class that I did before I left off, that you probably heard last week. Basically, how does indexing change now that you have to do web-scale indexing? At least some of the issues, okay? And I mentioned these slides last time, I'm going to just go over them quickly again, but the main important thing is, you know, some ideas that seem to work well in distributing the indexing aspect. Okay, so the big point down to keep in mind is disk seeks are expensive, main memory is fast. This is for people who don't know all this stuff, right? And also disks actually do block transfers. So getting one element from the block versus getting the entire block essentially costs the same. And so it would mean that you should organize your memory in such a way and organize your storage in the disk in such a way that you can do block transfer so that you can do things faster. Okay, these are some of the issues that you can't change. Okay, the other issues that you can't change is that at the web scale indexing, just as web scale crawling, you cannot do it on a single machine, even if it has huge amount of secondary and tertiary storage. Okay, from the speed point of view, it makes a lot of sense to have large number of machines and distribute them over multiple machines. And the question, of course, is how do you distribute? And, you know, we talked last time about this cluster computing idea, right? Any of you actually showed up and heard this cloud computing stuff that the university had day before yesterday or yesterday? Last week, I think. So ASU is actually getting into cluster computing and also called cloud computing. In general, all that means is if you are given a huge number of distributed cheap machines, how do you write your application in such a way that it can exploit the parallelism afforded, the coarse grain parallelism afforded by these clusters of machines? Okay, that's the issue. Okay, because as we mentioned, not everything can be parallelized. Okay, and furthermore, not everything can be parallelized at the right level of granularity that is available to you. So you have to write programs such that you can exploit the existing structure. So I can be given a million machines, but if I write my program in such a way that it works best on a single machine, then a million minus one machines are waiting idly for me. And in fact, it's been said in various talks at the Google Faculty Summit, etc., that the biggest problem they have when they have new people coming in and writing programs for them is for them to realize how to use this huge existing pool of machines. And so they developed, you know, most of the search engines, including Google, have developed some environments. You know, the MapReduce environment is one, which sort of allows you to do coarse-grained parallelism on these distributed machines. So you write your program using MapReduce constructs, and then the actual physical details of which machines are being used is done by a mediator, an intermediate layer. So you don't have to worry about which machine is doing what. You need to worry about structuring your program such that a huge number of machines can do your program together. Okay. So in doing the indexing, we basically will think about how can we do indexing such that multiple machines can be involved in it. Okay. Because we have thought about indexing doing in one machine. Okay, how do you make it such that everybody can be, if I have more and more machines available, how do you, you know, use that? And I mentioned this last time, I'm not going to go over it again, but again, the big deal is that there are huge numbers of these machines. We're talking about potentially, you know, millions of servers, because potentially 100,000 servers are being added each quarter, you know, in something like Google. And again, as I said, this is a huge trade secret. We don't quite know exactly how many. And then the other point, of course, is they have a huge number of cheap machines. That was another design decision. I will give you a link to Urs Hoogle, I guess, a video seminar by Urs Hoogle, who is one of the Google fellows who developed the original Linux cluster at Google. And you could hear him, you know, it's kind of fun. And it's a video, because so you can see his video as his slides as well as listen to him. But there are other places where you can get some of that information. But the big point is the design decision is to buy cheap machines off the shelf. And so even though they fail, you basically do fault tolerance because of the numbers. And you know, write your program such that it doesn't depend upon any single specific machine. That's the whole thing. And writing programs like this isn't easy. All I'm going to show you today is how you can think of converting something like indexing into a MapReduce architecture. For every such program, you need to write it that way. So for example, when you first heard about recursion, it was hard for you, unless you actually started thinking the right way about programming, which is to think of recursion first. If you did all this C++ kind of nonsense first, and then you came to 240 and heard about recursion, most of you would have had a hard time thinking about writing programs in a recursive way. Okay? Many things are inherently recursive programs, but you don't know how to write it that way. And so you get used to it over a period of time. And similarly for this sort of thing, MapReduce. There are ways of expressing some tasks that can use this. Okay? And again, as I said last time, MapReduce comes from the Lisp construct of mapping some operation, let's say, plus onto some list of entities, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, plus 1. So that means add plus 1 to each of these entities and then reduce the result by multiplication operation. And so what that means is you're going to do plus 1 for each of them. This becomes 4, this becomes 5, this becomes 6, this becomes 7, this becomes 8. Now, symbolically, you can think of each of these being done by a different machine. They're all parallelly adding 1 to each of the numbers. In Lisp, you know, as running on a single machine, it's actually the same CPU that does it. But when I map my computation this way, then this could have been a really complex program that takes half an hour to run for each entity. But now you can do that in each of these entities in one half an hour per entity. So you got massive parallelism, which is equal to the size of the queue. Okay, and then you do the reduce operation, which is now you basically you got this part, then you multiply 4 times, 5 times, 6 times, 7 times, 8, and give you the answer. This is the sequential part, and you remove the sequential part, put it outside. Okay, and you kept the parallelism in a coarse level. Okay, so as I said, even though plus 1 doesn't quite require an entire new machine, okay, think of this as a primality test, which is costly, let's say. Given a random number, you need to check whether or not it's a prime. And this is a bunch of huge numbers. This list is a bunch of huge numbers. And the primality test will say yes or no, 1 or 0. And reduce will tell you how many numbers in the original list were primes. Now all of a sudden it makes sense to check for primality of each number on a different machine. The nice thing, of course, is the number of machines you need depends on the input, right? If you have a 5-size queue, you need 5 machines. If you have a 10,000-size queue, you need 10,000 machines. Or, you know, if you have 100 machines and you have 10,000-size queue, then you can list, then you can do some number of them on each of the machines. All of this, you allow the map reduce architecture to take care of. But you write your program this way, the parallelism can occur. My question is, how can I do indexing this way? And the indexing idea that works, remember this is the inverted index, you know, that we talked about. The inverted index idea, basically remember you had to have term and document, which is a postings list. And then you get all of them, you can combine them into a single inverted list. The main point to understand is that given a document, bringing the terms from the document out can be done by a separate machine. Rather than getting the terms from this document, you can be getting terms from this document. We can be doing work together, parallelly. But then after we got all the terms from all the documents, then you need to reduce. You need to combine these term postings into a single inverted index. That's the reduce phase. That's how you convert normal indexing into, you know, map reduce architecture. Okay, and the basic idea of that's called the single pass in-memory indexing, and it's based on two ideas. You know, one is that you can generate separate dictionaries for each block of documents. Okay, and then each of those independent documents. So you start with, let's say, a billion documents. You split them into some number of blocks. They're called splits or blocks. Okay, let's say 1 million each. Okay, 1,000 splits of 1 million each. Okay, now for each 1 million block, I have one machine going through each document in that and getting the term document postings list out. And what it does is it throws that term document postings list. Let me show you this picture, then we'll come back to this. So I have 1 billion documents split into, so they have, you know, 1,000 splits. Okay, for each split, there is a parser machine. All a parser machine does is it takes the terms in this, converts them into these many occurrences of this term in this document. Okay? And what it then does is it throws them into essentially an intermediate index. All that basically is doing is all the postings of terms that begin with letters A to F are put here, G to P are put here, Q to Z are put here. And similarly, the next parser does the same thing, next parser does the same thing. So if I have a million splits here, I mean, 1,000 splits here, then I have 1,000 of these. And the 1,000 machines are working in parallel. Okay? Now having done this, now I have inverters. What inverters do is they take postings lists, sort them. Okay? Now, this A to F bucket, all we know is every posting that occurs is starting with a letter A to F. But they're not necessarily put in the right sorted order. So what this inverter, the first inverter does is it takes all the A to F buckets of these 1,000 intermediate indices and sorts them and puts this into an A to F index, sorted A to F index. And the next one does it to G to P, next one does it to Q to Z. Okay, now obviously here the parallelism is reduced because based on the way I split this, right, there are only 3 machines working in reduced space and there are 1,000 machines working in the map space. This basically is what you do if you want to exploit the distributed class of machines. Okay, the nice part is essentially the amount of parallelism depends on the number of documents and how many splits you made them into, which is sort of like that. Okay, you don't decide upfront. And you don't even need to decide, so in fact one of the things that the MapReduce architecture that is provided by Google, and in fact now it is available to universities. It's called Hadoop, H-A-D-O-O-P. And if you are more adventurous, I can make one of your projects be using Hadoop. Hadoop is a open domain, open source cluster computing architecture. Okay, and it can actually simulate cluster computing on a single machine or multiple machines. The point, of course, is that if you write something schematically, that particular MapReduce here corresponds to writing something like this in the MapReduce architecture, the programming environment. You're more or less saying this is the input and you reduce it to these things. Okay? And that's it. And then the number of machines that are actually used at each phase is determined by the underlying environment, which knows how many machines are there to begin with. Do you understand? Because the point is, this could have been done with thousand splits of the billion documents, or 2 splits of the billion documents, or just 1 split of the billion document. Nothing changes here. All that is important is to conceptually write the overall indexing such that there is a parallelization phase and there is a reduction phase. Now, is every possible computing task parallelizable this way? No, not really. But this, if they are parallelizable this way, it's extremely easy to exploit the cluster of machines. Okay, so then it's like for a man with a hammer in the hand, everything looks like a nail, hit on the people's head. So if I have MapReduce architecture, I look at every program and say, can I MapReduce it? Because if I can, I can do it faster. If not, I can't. Okay, but that's, so I'm doing 2 things at the same time in this part of the lecture. One is to explain to you, A, that large scale indexing requires more than one machine, and this is one way of doing it. And the second part is really this particular way of using parallelism of coarse-grained machines is a new one. I mean, that you may or may not have heard about before. There has been a lot of work in parallelism research, parallelizing programs and so on. This is not exactly one of the things that was talked about. In fact, years back, Partha Dasgupta, one of the guys here, used to work in something called Calypso system, which has some connections to this kind of direction, which is coarse-grained parallelism. Most of the parallel machines tended to be separately built parallel machines. Do you understand what I'm saying? That's a dumb idea because, a search engine has to go and tell the vendor, please give me 1,000 parallel machine, 1,000 CPU machine. That's a very painful thing to construct and they're extremely costly. Here you're buying individual machines off the shelf. But then there are only certain types of parallelism that they can be involved in. And it turns out that several of the things that Google is interested in, many of the search engines are interested in, have that kind of parallelism. And now what they want to do is, for a while when I first came here, Intel and Motorola were big players, and they would tell ASU, we need employees who already know Intel or Motorola assembly language, as if universities are invented only to train Intel and Motorola employees. Right? So for a while, they would have the introductory computer science course, Motorola version, introductory computer science course, Intel version. I used to cringe at the thought that we are developing employees rather than people who know how to learn. Right? Now, of course, Intel and Motorola are not as potent a force, but Googles of the world are, and they are now saying, why don't you prepare employees that we can easily get, and we don't even have to do internships for them. They can start, they can hit the ground running and help us do our work, as if universities are created to help just Google. right? So they are giving away things like Hadoop, which basically is an open source cluster computing architecture, and they are paying money to the universities to develop courses on this sort of cluster computing. And some of you mercenary students would like to take these courses, and it's not particularly bad. But on the other hand, I think computer science as a whole is way more than a single employer, because tomorrow Google may die, just as Intel and Motorola are no longer big forces, and you do want to understand principles that transcend companies. Okay? So although I describe to you how this stuff works and it's quite sexy and all that stuff, I do want you to say, I do want to say that I'm not going to convert this course into cluster computing course. You know, it's a nice way of thinking about the world, but that's okay. So I'm going to stop here. What we'll do next class is a couple of things about dynamic indexing and talk about anchor text a little more, and then shift into social networks, which is a hugely entertaining topic. Okay? And then we'll get back from there into link analysis. Stop here.